From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Charlottesville, Virginia, during the alt-right and white supremacist demonstrations. Scholars noticed an increasing usage of medieval themes and imagery. They raised concerns that neo-Nazis are misinterpreting history and offering inaccurate ideas about the Middle Ages and racial purity. A few days after Charlottesville, as reported by the CBC, professors writing for the Medieval Academy blog wrote the following, quote, "As scholars of the medieval world, we are disturbed by the use of a nostalgic but inaccurate myth of the Middle Ages by racist movements in the United States. By using imagined medieval symbols or names drawn from medieval terminology, they create a fantasy of a pure white Europe that bears no relationship to reality. This fantasy not only hurts people in the present, it also distorts the past," end quote. And the CBC went on to report that neo-Nazis are finding their way into the classroom, so the burden on academics is increasing. Perhaps not just enough to correct historical distortions. There's now a danger that a classroom could become a point of indoctrination. And one professor added, quote, "I am wondering how many of my students have consumed these kinds of narratives about a pure white Western European past that was in opposition to people who are different than themselves, and whether I've been doing enough to counter that and make sure that I don't accidentally, just by being silent, enable the spread of white supremacy," end quote. This is not the first time that white supremacists have tried to co-opt history and twist reality to suit their narratives, and that is just part of our focus for the hour, as we welcome a celebrated medievalist in the field, Professor David Wallace from the University of Pennsylvania, a guest at the University of Rochester, not just talking about what I brought to you in the introduction here. There are all kinds of, well, I suppose, twistings and distortions and misunderstandings of what we might call the Middle Ages. And we'll talk about that with Professor Wallace, who's here. It's great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
And also with us is Professor Thomas Hahn of the University of Rochester. Professor, welcome to you as well. Thank you for being here.
I'm pleased to be here.
There are three events to tell you about. We'll do those, at least several of them. I've got the whole list. I'll bring it to you in just a moment coming up here. But before we even dive in there, I want to ask Professor Hahn in particular, because you and your institution have brought so many noted people in their fields to the University of Rochester. What excites you most about the visit from Professor Wallace this week?
I think the Ferrari Humanities Symposium, which this is the sponsor of these events, is really one of the kind of great events that makes social what is all too often isolated and intellectual. That is, it brings people together in rooms to talk to one another. And obviously, this program itself is a version of how that works, in which we can reach out and talk to one another about really difficult subjects, I think, that make clear the need for us to have a historical perspective in order to actually operate with conscience and with a kind of sense of purpose in the present.
Let me mention both of the lectures. Today, 4 p.m. at the MAG, the Memorial Art Gallery, for a lecture titled Fascism, Medievalism, and the Rochester Legacy of Margaret Schlach. And
yes.
we'll get into that coming up here. Also, tomorrow, 5 p.m., Rush Reese Library, Sacrifice Your Daughter, Horrible History in Chaucer and the Book of Judges. So we will talk about both of those subjects coming up here in just a moment. But let's define what we mean when we say the Middle Ages here. Because, Professor, as you know, the Middle Ages was just a time of darkness, pestilence, disease, really sort of, I'm caricaturing now just to see if I can rile you up here. But when we talk about the Middle Ages, we're talking generally when to win.
Well, we're the Middle Ages, we're the victims of the greatest branding exercise in history, which is done by the Renaissance, right? And the Renaissance scholars decided, okay, we have a direct relationship to classical antiquity. We're smart, we're enlightened like they were, but what lies between us? Oh, it was the Middle Ages. And that was a brand invented in the early 15th century, and it carries on today. So the Middle Ages is everything that's sort of foul and repulsive, but it's continually sort of redefined. So 30 years ago, the Middle Ages was seen as repulsive because it was good to be orderly. But then when it was fashionable to be sort of avant-garde and gothic, suddenly the Middle Ages was orderly and the Renaissance wasn't. So we're just endlessly redefined in that way. So, but it's very successful because it speaks to a modern individualism. The Renaissance person is an individual and the medieval person is just a kind of sheep or a member of a collective.
Okay. And when it comes to a time period, roughly 1,000 years kind of?
Yeah. A better Middle Ages is really to say between the declines of the great empires of antiquity like Rome and the rise of the great empires of the modern times like Spain and Britain eventually. So that 1,000 years, 500 to 1500.
Are you blaming medieval scholars, I'm sorry, Renaissance scholars for this poor reputation that the Middle Ages have had over all these centuries?
I blame them for lazy perpetuation of that original founding thing. But it's in their interest because everybody loves what is new, right? Everything's perpetually new. I mean, the recent ad says, OK is not OK, right? It needs to be better than OK, and better than OK is the Renaissance.
I'm really going to enjoy this conversation. And I think we're going to really enjoy hearing about what the lectures are bringing us. But it has been jarring, and Professor Hahn, it has been jarring to see some of the imagery that we see in the neo-Nazi movements.
That's true.
And so what's going on there? What's at the core of this?
Well, I think it's another version of rebranding. That is, it's taking the Middle Ages and using it as a kind of brand by which we can talk about the things that are kind of most central to, let's say, in this case, white supremacism. So I think that it's worth pointing out that the gunman who committed the massacre at the mosque in New Zealand actually had Charles Martel and AKA 1189 on his weapons as ways of referring to two battles in which Christians defeated Muslims. Clearly, what he was trying to signal by those remarks, by those markings, was a sense, in other words, of the unified Christianity of Europe and its preservation of its own rights. In fact, of course, the whole history is much more complicated than that, both in terms of Charles Martel and the Crusades. The Crusades had established Christian outposts and various kinds of intercultural interactions for 200 years before 1180, or almost 200 years before 1189. So all in all, I think that there's a kind of a sense here that the medieval is being now turned into something that can be used as aspirational. For example, the notion that the wall that the administration wants to build on our southern border has been described as medieval by our president. And the notion there, in other words, is that somehow by designating it medieval, we are playing into that kind of notion of a unified society with purity of race as a kind of crucial feature.
Do you view the criticism of the wall as a symbol of white nationalism, as Adam Serwer and other journalists have written about?
I think that there's a good case to be made for that. And I think there's a good historical case to be made for it as well, starting with kind of so-called scientific racism in the mid-19th century, because that kind of racism right through Nazi Germany actually talked about immigration almost as much as we are talking about it now. So the sense, in other words, of the purification of race has always had an anti-immigrant component to it.
Well, you know, my concern whenever I see any kind of movement co-opting complex themes, of which 1,000 years of history surely is much more complex than it gets sort of credit for, or lack of credit for, is that you read half an article or you take, you know, one semester of a class and you think that you're ready to tell the world that you are the expert now. And it's remarkable for me, you know, Professor Hahn, when I see some of the postings, some of the more sort of virulent strains of white nationalism, the pose that they strike as experts, and we're just simply returning to our roots and our past and celebrating those things at a time when it was more pure. You know, what's the first kind of rebuttal that you would offer to that?
I think that any understanding, any complex understanding of the past would obviously dismiss the sense of purity. And even when we talk about branding, we're talking about a kind of centralized understanding of something that refuses what's around the edges. And once one begins to look into, for example, the nature of the Crusades or the kind of global contacts that existed in Europe across the Middle Ages, one begins to see very clearly how many different kinds of interactions there were, how fully aware medieval people were of not only resident aliens like Jewish people who lived in Europe, but also, many other kinds of difference. And this carries over as well into the British Isles. I mean, the sense, in other words, that in what has been called the first British Empire, there was this attempt of the kind of the central island, England, to take over Wales and Ireland and so on. And a good deal of discourse that was written in the 12th and 13th centuries about this raises these same questions about the complexity of racial and tribal makeup, of the behaviors of people, both in terms of kind of a genetic notion of identity, but also in terms of social and political conditions, the ways in which we think about an identity of or a racial identity as cultural as well as biological.
It's worth pointing out that these medieval English knights that these racist people think they're imitating, these medieval English knights thought they were descended from Asian immigrants because they were descended from ancient Troy, and ancient Troy is on the coast of Turkey. So that's what they thought they came from. They were immigrants. They were Asians. This was the English aristocratic class. And the people who were really different from them were not people in other nations. They were the nativi, the sons of the soil, people who just were the laborers. They were almost like a different race, a different class. And there's a greater gulf between, say, the medieval English knight and the medieval English peasant than there would be between a medieval English knight and, say, a Saracen knight. They could sort of talk across that divide in ways that they couldn't even relate to their own people. So the Middle Ages had all sorts of very complicated differentiations, but you can't simply map them onto what's going on now. It makes no sense.
So tell me a little bit about the mission behind your work, David. And I ask that because I think you're right. The branding issues for Middle Ages are serious,
right,
and pretty well embedded, at least from my perspective. How do you go about trying to sort of rebrand? And then for you, what is the mission? Because maybe the Renaissance scholars would say, well, you're simply buffing up and trying to shine up the edges of a darker course here. So what would you say the mission is of your work?
Just simply to lay out what the Middle Ages actually was like. I did a literary history of Europe, which I did through a series of voyages and journeys, 9 different journeys, to show that there's tremendous differentiation and nuance between one place and another place. There are not national blocks. We're long before the age of nationalism. But we've needed medieval narratives to provide this sort of foundational text for nations like Germany, the Nibelungenlied, or the Song of Roland for France. We've adopted these things, but these don't correspond to the ways actually these stories worked originally. So,
and I mentioned before the program began that I had read the book The Swerve by Stephen Greenblatt, who was a guest at the University of Rochester a couple of years ago. He was a guest on this program. If I were reading one book to help understand what kicked off the Renaissance and really what, you know, kind of to emerge from the mire of the Middle Ages, that would be probably, well, just that framing probably drives you a bit mad.
Yeah, I mean, Stephen Greenblatt writes beautifully. He's a smart guy, but he's replicating the ideas of a guy called Burckhardt, who wrote a book called The Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy in 1860. And he said, in the Middle Ages, people thought of themselves as members of a group, a guild, a profession, a church, only collectively, but in the Renaissance, people emerged as the individual. Only in the Renaissance do you get the sense of the individual. Well, I would say, what's wrong with thinking of yourself as a member of a collective, as a group, and the rest of it? So, you know, this sort of celebration of individualism is very problematic. I would say that Donald Trump is a Renaissance man in Greenblatt's terms, because there's a very famous dictum from Roman law used in the Renaissance. It's quod principi placuit legis habet vigorum. What is pleasing to the prince has the force of law. Whatever I like is the law. Now, that is the ideal that Trump would love, if you think about it. That was what he would like. And the way he projects himself is like a Renaissance prince, with a careful kind of golden helmet of hair and the careful control of the image. He is the Renaissance potentate, as against the medieval traditions of endless sort of democratic consultation, the jury system, the extraordinary governance that you get locally in the Middle Ages. So we kind of love them. We love the Medici, but we don't realize that the Medici are despots and dictators who actually hollowed out and replaced the democracy of Florence.
Well, and so this is exactly where I think it's fair to say that the caricature emerges the most, which is that there are almost no essential achievements of the Middle Ages, that when the world emerged from that darkness, then we could achieve, that we could build a civil society. I'm sure you disagree fundamentally, but what are the achievements of the Middle Ages that stand out to you?
Well, I mean, universities come from the Middle Ages. Medicine is transmitted from this tremendous kind of transfer of knowledge from Greece in Arabic sources to southern Spain, translated by Jewish translators. One of the achievements is a period called convivencia, of living together, of the three faiths in southern Spain, Jewish, Islamic, and Christian communities living together. And also like things like the jury system, right, that some people get tired of. That's a wonderful, very antique invention. And I think thinking collectively, believing collectively, and it's called feudal mutuality. You do have hierarchies where you have priests at the top, the church, the knights and the people. And so the knights provide protection, the church spiritual leadership, and the peasants food. But everybody is required to provide it to everybody else. It's called feudal mutuality. What you get with absolutism, which is the Renaissance model, is you owe allegiance upwards to the monarch, and he owes nothing to you because he is absolute and he is godlike. Think of Henry VIII.
Professor?
It's worth noting as well that one of the medieval inventions that has had most lasting influence is the one that Mitt Romney talked about as corporations are people too. That is the very notion of a corporation, that is a group that can stand as an individual before the law, is something that was invented at the time of the universities. And as much as it may be abused, it's really crucial to think about this kind of notion that we can envisage a corporate identity that, you know, kind of stands for something institutional and have its own kind of autonomy. And that's a pure medieval invention.
So when it comes to the collective, I don't want to take Professor Wallace's words and over-apply them, because one of the lessons is not to overgeneralize about just about anything. But if we are looking at the Renaissance in the way that maybe many of the scholars have framed it, which is this more individualized, individual achievement and striving, and as you sort of cheekily said, well, what's wrong with the collective and that the Middle Ages maybe did promote more of? Are we reaching a point in our own political debates where those same questions are reemerging, that this question on collective good is sort of reasserting itself into the center of our political spheres?
Yeah, collective good is a lovely medieval phrase. It's bonum commune, the good of the commons. So there is a central debate going on in America, isn't there, between thinking about the good of the great, you know, of everybody, something that's all inclusive, the good for everybody, and the rights of the individual to go off and be as individual as they could possibly be. Yeah.
Are they mutually exclusive, forever at odds?
Well, hopefully not. Yeah, there should be room for brilliant entrepreneurial genius, that's for sure, but never completely untethered from responsibility to, you know, collective identity, I would say.
Okay. How do you feel about that, Professor Hunt?
I would agree with what David just said. I don't have too much to add to that.
Okay. Well, I want to get a comment from a listener. And Joel writes to us and urged me. He said, you ought to early on distinguish between medieval and medievalism. Mm-hmm. That is not at all my expertise, but my guests are nodding about that. So medieval versus medievalism.
So medievalism is the study of the Middle Ages in post-medieval times. And that study can be a kind of serious inquiry into, let's say, 18th century Gothic or the Houses of Parliament in the 19th century, which are clearly produced in a completely un-Victorian way to look like the Middle Ages. But it can also be the kinds of things we were talking about at the beginning of the hour. That is the kind of reprocessing of pseudo-medieval ideas for service of a particular cause in the present. So both of those, I think, are taken in under the category of medievalism.
Okay. You want to add to that?
I think that's an excellent thing. I want to just add something to what I said about supporting both sides, because I'm from the University of Pennsylvania. We have the Wharton School of Business. We did produce Donald Trump. Right. So I'm not anti-business. I think entrepreneurialism is really, really important, but I also believe in collective responsibility.
That's the second time we've had Trump invoked. And as a Renaissance man, I don't think we expected Professor Wallace to call the president a Renaissance man, but more as a pejorative, a little bit of a needle.
I would say a descriptor.
Michael writes to us to say the grammar in high school history taught us that Charles Martel was a hero. The nuns taught us that he saved France from being conquered by the Muslims. Is that not true?
It's true as a high school or grammar school history lesson, I think. But obviously, so both of those allusions are notions of creating borders, another kind of version of a wall. That is stopping something from crossing a particular point. And the point is defined in both of those as either Christianity in the Crusades or France in Charles Martel. But again, I think the ways in which any sense of French or Christian corporate identity comes together is much more complicated than some notion of on one day, one individual achieve this thing that, you know, kind of stands for all of history.
But also this idea that Islam is external to Europe and foreign to Europe is completely historically not true, because Islam spread very, very quickly along the North African coast into southern Spain and was there for, 600 years? Mm-hmm. I mean, until, you know, the 14th, 15th century. It's constitutive of European identity. It's got a long, long pedigree.
But why then, in 2019, are there so many discussions about, and not just on sort of white supremacist terms, but often on white supremacist terms, on the hand-wringing about the Islamization of Europe as if it doesn't have any historical precedent?
I think people just have forgotten to read their history. It's always been there. Think about southern Spain and how quite wonderful that culture is. Think of flamenco, think of the music, think of the food, think of everything about it, think of the language. That's not possible without the long Islamic presence in southern Spain.
Well, Joel follows up with this. He writes to us to say, to me, it's important to make distinctions between what happened, as best as we know, in the Middle Ages regarding Jews, Muslims, Christians, etc., and what happened since during the Renaissance and especially during the 19th and 20th centuries that either bastardized, misused, misinterpreted, etc., medieval history. Lots of people, not just racists or white supremacists, can be studied to see that there are various ways in which people interpret the past, sometimes very incorrectly, either for intentional or accidental purposes. I think that the highly inaccurate Braveheart, or better still, 300, which actually got so much wrong about Persians, Spartans, and slaves, yet is used as a film to recruit soldiers in the U.S. military. I've never had a veteran in my classes, Joel writes, who has not seen that film. Our case is in point. Even the Boy Scouts, as Professor Hahn will point out, used from its beginning ideas about honor, valor, and especially chivalry in its early teachings and Boy Scout manuals, sidestepping the tremendous violence of medieval knights. But you have to start by defining the Middle Ages medieval and medievalism. So that comes from Joel.
I would agree that we're all in the interpretation game. We're not here sort of laying down the law. We're two more guys with an opinion, okay, in a kind of public debate. Braveheart's a great example. I actually was asked to teach that because my name is Wallace, right? I don't really resemble Mel Gibson or the historical Braveheart. But people expected to be shocked at the way the film was fairly romanticized and all sorts of things were invented that really didn't happen. But all we've got is sources which are themselves fairly romanticized and, you know, just fictionalized accounts from the period of the Middle Ages. So there is no definitive historical account. There are just various versions of.
So one of the most striking forms of medievalism is, in fact, the cinema. There have been more than 100 versions of the Robin Hood story, if you count made-for-TV movies and so on. And none of those would be thought of as in any way historically accurate. So I think that it's very difficult to teach medieval history from such artifacts, but it's possible to talk about how those films work in terms of their own time. The first million-dollar film, for example, was Douglas Fairbanks' Robin Hood in 1922. And that movie is as much about America becoming a world power and taking a place on a stage, the Crusades as a kind of version of World War I in retrospect, as it is about the Middle Ages. And so I think that that sense, in other words, that Hollywood is going to try to actually appeal to the values of its contemporary audiences rather than try to unpack what the past is about, that's always going to be the case if we're talking about popular culture.
Professor, tell me the name again of the film 1922. The
Douglas Fairbanks in Robin Hood.
That's the first million-dollar film.
Yep, million-dollar budget, right.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And because it was silent, obviously, it was a universal hit. Fairbanks and Mary Pickford, his wife, were mobbed everywhere, in London, in Moscow, just everywhere in between, because that film actually was, in many ways, I think was the breakthrough film in American popular culture becoming international popular culture, and it was medieval.
Well, I always thought of Mel Gibson, by the way, as a Renaissance man. See the theme?
David would agree with that.
You see what we've done there? Kathy in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Kathy.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just finished a book, A World Lit Only by Fire, and I was wondering if your guests were familiar with it and whether they think it's a good book for laymen. And also, it is my understanding that there were Jews living in Jerusalem unopposed up until the Crusades when the Christians evicted them. So I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Okay, Kathy, thank you. Go ahead, gentlemen.
I don't know the book. Do you, Tom?
So this is the same author who wrote The Clash of Civilizations. And I think that, this is a kind of 1980s, perhaps, you know, version of the kind of fundamental rift between Christianity and Islam. I think that I haven't read The World Lit Only by Fire, but my sense of it is that it looks back quasi-nostalgically and quasi-condemningly on the Middle Ages as pre-industrial, pre-technological, prehistoric in some ways.
Okay. And I had a separate question from a listener wondering about a book that I own and haven't finished, A Distant Mirror by Barbara Tuchman, if that is a good work to consume.
I think it's a pretty decent book, yeah, I got to say. Yeah.
So we had Barbara Tuchman come to the Rochester campus, and this gives a little bit away about my own age, in 1976, I believe, when that book came out. And clearly it's a book that's really wonderful in terms of a kind of crisis in the 14th century. But at the time, I remember thinking that it doesn't really address any sense of causality, that it offers a kind of good description of events in ways that engage modern readers, but without actually sort of addressing the question of, like, what do we make of the connections between all of these different events? And so
you sound like a professor there, Tom, I got to say.
I remember the first review that when I was thinking about picking up the book, though, said, a good description of what delayed the Renaissance. You know, we were on the cusp of a breakthrough, but then, you know, pestilence and... Yeah.
Another Bart Simpson moment, isn't it? Sort of, dull, you know.
So close.
That's right.
To the real Enlightenment.
That's right.
That would not be a fair way to describe... And I don't even think that Barbara Tuchman would have described the book probably that way. That was more of a review. I don't know. I hope not. No. Do you think, David, no? Yeah. Well, listeners, if you want to join the conversation, we've got plenty of feedback rolling in from you. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. In a moment after our only break of the hour, we're going to talk about the lectures that are coming our way today and tomorrow, Fascism, Medievalism, and the Rochester Legacy. And I'm going to ask for it's Schlauk. Margaret Schlauk is the name. We'll talk about that. And tomorrow, Sacrifice Your Daughter, Horrible History in Chaucer and the Book of Judges. We'll talk about both of those on the other side of this break. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with a Democrat running for Monroe County District Attorney. It's Shawnee Curry Mitchell. She's challenging the incumbent, Sandra Dorley. We're going to sit down with the incumbent 2 weeks from now. Today, it's our first chance to sit down with the challenger. Your questions answered next hour. We'll talk about the platform and the ideas from Shawnee Curry Mitchell next hour on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And before we get into the subject of the lectures, I just want to return for one moment with, especially with Professor Thomas Hahn from the University of Rochester, to put a finer point, because we had some listeners questioning the entire usage of imagery and, you know, asking, are we going to see more of this if white nationalism emerges, et cetera? There is a history, which we'll connect in just a moment. This is not the first time in history that the Middle Ages medieval imagery has been used in this way. You expect we'll see more of this as these movements either grow or fight to grow?
I do. And I think we'll see, iterations of it that look very different perhaps from what's existing now. So just to go to Margaret Schlauk for a moment, in the 1930s, the period that David has been working on, she produced this book called Who Are the Aryans? Schlauk was a medievalist teaching at NYU. As well as a linguist, and she uses that pamphlet, it's about 30-something pages, as a means to actually make clear the kind of nonsensical arguments on a scientific basis, either philology or biology, for purity of language or purity of race or the existence even, and the continued existence through thousands of years of Aryans. So I think that was a kind of 30s version of this white supremacy, and toward the end of the book she talks about kind of loose and foolish talk as a way of actually... damaging our sense of who we are and where we aspire to go.
Yeah, I mean, the Nazis really did appropriate medieval imagery, didn't they?
They did.
In this way, and the idea being that there was some sort of racially pure past that could be resurrected in some sense. Professor Wallace, can you tell us a little bit about what's coming our way at the Memorial Art Gallery today, 4 p.m., Fascism, Medievalism, and the Rochester Legacy of Margaret Schlauk?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about, firstly, what was going on in Europe in the 1930s, because Margaret Schlauk had a very good idea what was going on. She traveled to Germany in the 20s and also Iceland, Denmark in the 30s, and so she knew what was happening there. So then it gives some sense of what indeed was going on there, uses of the medieval again. For example, the Oberammergau Passion Play has been going on for 300 years, and it's a sort of medieval-style play. Every 10 years, the next one is actually next year. In 1934, Hitler decided to go, and he disguised himself as a Scandinavian tourist, but he sat in the middle of the people, having that kind of intense experience, identifying with that mass experience, which, as I said, is a medieval idea. The medieval is used in all sorts of other ways, particularly also trying to kidnap the idea of the Nordicness. Nordicness is important for Nazism as well. And so the Nazis actually got hold of the Bayeux Tapestry, and Hitler thought of himself as a new Norman, William the Conqueror. And so the Nazis, Goering actually went to Iceland on a tour, things like that. So there are all these sort of wild appropriations of giving some kind of credence or lineage to Nazism. So that is what Schlauch knew was going on, and that's what she set herself against as a member of an anti-communist group, which she did very courageously in the 1930s as a professor at NYU. And then she, during World War II, actually supplied texts for the American GIs who were based in Iceland. There are more American GIs in Iceland than there were Icelandic males at the time. So it's a very big outpost. But she carried on being a communist and a Marxist, and that got her in trouble in the 1950s under McCarthyite proceedings.
I'm curious to know if you agree with my observation, just that I would assume that you didn't have Nazis created after, a group of people led by Hitler or others who studied medieval history and thought, well, that let's go back to that. My assumption is that their racism was looking for justification, and that it lighted upon something that could be easily bent to their narrative.
Yeah, that's right, and creating something that's external to them. They're being rather baggy themselves. What do you define yourself as against? And of course, that's where anti-Semitism comes in. The Jews are everything that you are, that you oppose, that you are not. So it's almost like an external definition of what you are.
I also am curious. I'm thinking of some of the recent comments in the current presidential campaign. By among others, but a consistent theme from Mayor Pete Buttigieg from South Bend, Indiana, which is that that there is almost never something constructive about wanting to return to the past. That nostalgia is understandable, normal. There's something even beautiful about that. But actively trying to pull societies backwards into the past has a really dangerous, at least deleterious impact, whether it's economically, understanding the future of manufacturing, automation, et cetera, the notion of promising that all of coal or manufacturing is going to come back exactly as it was a generation ago, or the notion of going back to some sort of time in the Middle Ages, some supposed time when things were more racially pure and that people thought well enough of their own races to defend them against others or outsiders. Is there a danger in looking backwards as a way to try to go forward, as opposed to looking backwards to understand?
I think there is. I think the greatest example for me personally, being English by origin, is what's going on with Brexit. There, you sort of sold people on an idea of revivifying glories of an earlier time where, England ruled the globe, and we think we can somehow go back to that in some simple way, and that's proved to be a disastrous formula that's going to have very bad consequences for a long, long time.
Yeah. Well, since we're a couple days away from Brexit, I haven't seen what Ladbroke says yet, but in terms of the updated odds, are we going to delay this forever, or is this going to happen?
I don't know. Nobody knows. If I knew that answer, I'd be somewhere else.
What would you like to see happen?
Well, I'd like it never to have happened. I would like a second vote, which is it's very difficult to do that, but that's what I think would be the best outcome for it, for Britain to rejoin Europe. Because if you think of the European Union is, in a sense, a solution to the period we're talking about, 1,000 years of struggle, conflict, bloodshed, fighting between various groups in Europe, solved by a union of nations after World War II that stopped that from happening.
A collective.
It's one of the great achievements in human history. There's nothing like it. Nothing compares to it. That happened. And then suddenly people get bored with it and let's go back to nationalism. Why?
Is it fair to say they're simply bored with it?
Yeah. No, I think it's true.
Okay. Professor Hahn, how do you feel about the notion of sort of backwards looking as a way to look forward?
So, right. So any attempt to relive the past is, it seems to me, a kind of fantasy, a version of medievalism. And it seems to me about not just purity, that is, in other words, the invocation of some ancestor culture that gives meaning to our present life, but it's also about unity. because racism is a mechanism for actually setting borders, for making people feel included or excluded. And so the way it works is to actually invoke history as the justification for those kinds of mechanisms, and then to put them in place. So it's really about what you feel. There's a social scientist who says race matters if you think it does. And it seems to me that this is exactly what's going on with the invocation of these nostalgic pasts and so on.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. And this is Kathy. This is Rich in Rochester. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Very good.
I always argue, I don't think there's ever, and I almost say this 100%, there's never been such a thing as the good old days. Even if you were well off, at any point in history, you're not better off than you are today. There was a level of dehumanization in the past that you just don't have now with everything. Health-wise, I don't understand why people look back to the past and actually think they're going to find something better than there is today. I just don't think it's ever existed for anyone. I don't even think the billionaires of the Gilded Age were better off than we are today. I just don't think that existed.
I'm trying to think, Rich. I think George Will wrote a column maybe a year or two ago arguing that a billionaire in the year 1915 would have a lower quality of life than, sort of someone in the middle class or lower middle class in the United States today. So that's kind of the Steven Pinker argument, that the world has never been safer, the people have never been healthier, and that while we strive to create more egalitarianism and more opportunity to at least acknowledge some of the gains, my concern is complacency when you start doing that. But the notion of looking backwards for a model or a template, I do think is a little dicey. Professor Wallace, how do you feel about what Rich is, the argument he's making, that at least in so many ways, yes, we've got a long way to go, but we've never really had it quite so good?
I think it's very difficult to say. I mean, imagine that you're a medieval laborer in the 14th century. You go and do your plowing every day, which is better than CrossFit. You're incredibly fit. You're incredibly buff. You live on the outdoors. You've got a belief system which makes you very happy and secure. And you believe you're going to, when you eventually die, you're going to inherit eternal life. I'm not sure that's a worse life than the life we live today.
Okay. Professor Hahn?
So again, I think it's this kind of sense of wanting to relive the past rather than simply to kind of investigate the past. I think that in terms of how well off we are right now or where we want to go next, understanding any part of the past in a complex way will be an aid to that. In fact, I think that the notion that one can get lost in the past as a kind of maze, that it cuts us off or depletes our energy for living in the present and pushing for change, that seems to me actually not to be the case, that the past can become a kind of spur to action and activism. And so I think it's important to kind of engage the past rather than simply try to relive it or praise it.
Don writes to us and says, can your guest tell us about the Andalusian paradise? How real was it? How did it end?
This is the Convivencia. Mm. Right. So this is it. I think that probably some of our kind of more praising versions of this, of people, communities living in conjunction to one another and actually with kind of easy exchange and so on, that is probably true for 13th, 14th century. Obviously, by the 15th century, it becomes much more difficult. The frontiers, another version of borders, become much more important. And then the Reconquista ends all of that. But I think that it is a kind of decidedly important feature of medieval Europe, and Europeans who were not living in Andalusia were aware of that kind of exchange going on.
Okay, thanks, Don. John, next on the phone. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Yeah, I want to ask your panel about the Nazis in the 1930s. Heard and read some book by Dinesh D'Souza, who's a conservative author.
Yeah, largely discredited, but go ahead.
Well, in your opinion, he's discredited. I think he.
Of actual scholars and historians, but go ahead.
And right, on the left.
No, but go ahead.
On the left.
No.
Yeah.
Not on the left.
On the left.
On the right.
Let's get over that.
Anyways, okay.
And he has said and authored that the Nazis in the 1930s used the Democratic Party platform from the 1920s, which was very Jim Crow, very anti-African American, and they used that as a model to help their quest against the Jews in Germany. You have any thoughts on that?
I will kick your question to the panel, but I will ask you, if I email you, I don't know, 30 conservative academics who have worked hard to dismiss D'Souza's claims, will you at least acknowledge that this is not just a left-right thing?
Well, yeah, you can do that. But speaking to that, William Federer and Dr. Paul Kengor, they've also talked about the rise of the Islam through the centuries into Europe, and they maintain that the Islam was spurred by Prophet Muhammad, who was a genocidal maniac, and it was an aggression to Europe, and they had to beat him off in self-defense.
Okay. Well, John, thank you. Let's start with 1930s Germany first. Some of the thoughts there. Go ahead, Professor Wallace.
The first part I don't want to get anywhere near, but the second part is interesting. There's a great Jewish scholar called Salo Witmar Baron who actually traces the early history of Islam, and it says through the sheer dynamism of its spread, you know, in the 8th century across the North African coast to Southern Africa, it actually revived everywhere economically, and it revived Jewish communities. So there are very productive phases of interaction there. So I don't recognize the broader caricature.
Okay.
Perhaps worth pointing out that PBS is actually airing Skip Gates's Reconstruction documentary, which is connected to the book he's just published called Stony the Road. And this is an attempt to look at Reconstruction, the period of redemption, as it's called after that, and then Jim Crow. And I think that Skip Gates might agree with your caller about where some of these ideas might have come from among the Nazis. But again, it's an attempt to just appropriate something from another source and reuse it for your own purposes. In other words, it doesn't make the Democrats look good, but it's certainly, I think, a kind of a not unparalleled move in politics.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about tomorrow. At 5 p.m. tomorrow at Rush Rees Library is hosting a lecture titled Sacrifice Your Daughter, Horrible History in Chaucer and the Book of Judges. You want to give us a little preview of that, Professor Wallace?
Yeah, the key issue here is the very interesting fact that in the Bible, three children are sentenced to be sacrificed to death at the hands of their fathers. And the two boys, people may recognize who they are, Isaac and Jonathan, both are spared at the last minute by God. But the daughter, who's the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite, is not spared, and she is then sacrificed. And this is a really horrible story. Why is the one female representative not sacrificed? And it vexed people for 1,000 years. People could not find any sense in it. People tried very, very hard. And so I'm looking at how people dealt with that really, really horrible history.
What's one of the ways they dealt with it?
Oh, you're going to have to come to the
lecture. I know. Look what you've done. That's a very effective tease there. Horrible history in Chaucer, though. What's the connection with Chaucer?
Chaucer actually uses that particular story for a really horrible history of his own, in which a father indeed decapitates his own daughter for her best interests.
Decapitated her?
Yeah, because he doesn't want the family, because she is fallen into the hands of a judge, and the judge will have his wicked way with her unless the father can step in and behead her. It's horrible. It's a terrible story. It actually makes the listeners sick, actually, in the Chaucerian tale. Everybody said this is just horrible.
And it makes some of the caricatures that people volley about regarding the Middle Ages, it sort of bolsters some of those caricatures.
Well, not at all, because the medieval people themselves said this is just too horrible. Let's have a happy story. Let's have a different kind of tale. And then you get the Pardoner's story, which is much more upbeat.
Worth noting, perhaps, that both the main story and the Jephthah story are both classical and biblical. So Chaucer is recycling these horrible histories.
Oh, but I like that. It was the medieval population themselves who took issue with that. They didn't wait for the Renaissance anyway.
No, they didn't.
Okay.
No.
I would have assumed, given the history. That's tomorrow, 5 p.m., Sacrifice Your Daughter at Rush Rees Library. And you're hearing from Professor Wallace this hour why I would probably listen to him do an hour on his shoes if he wants to talk about it.
You keep pushing this Renaissance thing at me a little bit, so I'm going to give you one more example of Donald Trump as a Renaissance man, okay? The early Renaissance princes, as described by Burckhardt in 1860, proved themselves to be absolute rulers by doing really, really crazy short-term things like arbitrary exercises of power. So you think you've got them worked them out, then they go in a completely wacko direction. This is exactly what Donald Trump does. He simply will, you know, he'll just act out of the box, he'll do strange things. This is classic Renaissance prince behavior.
Okay. Look at the parallels drawn cogently this hour by Professor Wallace. Jeff in Fairport next on the phone. Go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, yes. I don't know if your guest there is familiar with Stephen Cohen of Columbia University.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
Oh, well, anyways, I happened to hear him on an interview in the New York City area a few days ago. And basically, his premise, I think, on why the EU, the UK is promoting Brexit and why it's Brexit and why it's favoring that way. He says the whole world order has shifted with China, Iran, and Russia, with friends in Germany and France, and the UK is actually getting cut out of the whole deal, and that's why they seem to be drawn to English speaking countries like Australia, New Zealand, and also the United States. And I'm just wondering if is there any credibility to that premise?
There is a fantasy that the UK has that our former Commonwealth subjects will welcome us back with open arms. Australia and Canada will have fantastic trade deals and be like the good old days. But that's complete fantasy because Australia is now completely involved with the Pacific Rim. Canada's got its own spheres of influence. So that's fantastical. But I do agree the world order is changing because I've always been interested in Europe and dedicate a lot of time to that. But the new concept coming in is Eurasia. Because Europe is not a continent, it's a continuous space. And you can go all the way to China, like Marco Polo did. And Eurasia is becoming a thing to think with because China is building out enormous infrastructure into the West. And it's coming and it's coming and it's coming at the very time that the United States has withdrawn strategically into a kind of isolationism. So China really is having a kind of free play right now.
We're getting bonus Brexit conversation this hour, but a lot of interest from our listeners. And one of our listeners wrote in, pushing back on the notion that that Britons were bored in voting for Brexit. He said they did not like immigration.
Well, it depends who you're talking, which part of the population. So the population of London, in which you have an extraordinary multicultural population, voted overwhelmingly in favor of staying in the European Union. And the people who live in the sort of post-industrial marginalized towns, very often on the coasts further north, voted for Brexit, but they have very little to do with immigrants. So there's a tremendous conflation as well between the free movement within Europe, which is a great thing, and the specters of sort of immigrants from other parts of the world, which the pro-Brexit people deliberately conflated. They had pictures of desperate migrants in desperate parts of the world as if they were coming into England in huge numbers.
Hmm. Well, we shall see here. And again, our professor this hour is offering no guidance should you be calling Ladbrokes on where to place your wagers. Hard to tell at this point. In our last couple of minutes, just some final thoughts from both of our professors, because we've covered a lot of ground here, and I think it's been a really useful re-education regarding how we view the Middle Ages, taking us away from the caricature to looking at some of the complexities, the achievements, the philosophies. But the work going forward for you, I mean, do you suspect this will always be an uphill battle because of the very, very successful caricature of the Middle Ages for so long?
I think so, but I think we have to take our term of abuse, which is medieval. You remember the famous getting medieval on your ass, right, in Pulp Fiction,
yes.
Right? Well, we take a lesson from, like, gay people, like queer used to be a term of abuse. Now they take it as a badge of pride. Okay, we're queer. That's who we are. So, okay, we are medievalists. We're proud of our culture. We're proud of the 1,000 years of education that we represent.
And that's an interesting point to Pulp Fiction, which I'm not even sure what going medieval on someone would be other than to be, I guess, just barbarically violent.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. So just distilling it to it's just barbarism.
That's right.
Okay. Well, taking it back, taking back a term and changing the connotation. Professor Han, how do you feel about that challenge itself going forward and maybe some of the work of your colleague here?
Well, I think what I'd say is we want to study the past for its own sake, for sure. But I also think that it gives us ways of understanding our present situation that we wouldn't otherwise have. And just to go for a moment to the issue of race, there are people who think race doesn't exist in the Middle Ages. I think David's a bit of a skeptic. And yet, it seems to me that there are all kinds of instances that suggest a kind of uneven development of how racial mechanisms work, of how race actually operates between different groups of people. And what we get out of that is some better sense of how to understand what people think of the classic moments of race, the transatlantic slave trade or plantation slavery and so on, the kinds of things that Gates is talking about in Reconstruction. Those are not the only models, and the difference that these earlier models make, the kind of the way in which they look unfamiliar to us, give us an opportunity to use that unfamiliarity to estrange our kind of common understandings of what happens in the 18th, 19th century.
I want to tell you one more time, today, 4 p.m. at the Memorial Art Gallery for Fascism, Medievalism, and the Rochester Legacy of Margaret Schlauch, if you want to attend that. Tomorrow, 5 p.m. at Rush Reese Library for Sacrifice Your Daughter. You can attend both if you like. And Professor David Wallace, thank you for taking the time for us and for our listeners this hour. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. It's been fun.
Our thanks to Thomas Hahn, professor from the University of Rochester. Thank you to you as well.
Pleased to be here.
All right. Short break. More Connections coming up.